Good. This is another in a series of oral history interviews done by the University Archives and Special Collections Unit at Illinois Institute of Technology. Today we're in the Donnelly Room of Galvin Library, November the 13th, 2017, and we'll be speaking with Howard Levant, who's a graduate of the Institute of Design 1958. I am Ralph Pugh, University Archivist, and interviewing along with me is Adam Strome, Director of University Archives and Special Collections. So. It's good to have you come on in from Rochester.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Spend a few days with us. Our opening question will be, tell us as much about your formative years as you would like to talk about before we get to your photographic career.
Okay. People always ask me, how did you become a photographer? Okay. And in seventh grade, three of my best friends, because I'd have a camera club, and I knew nothing at all about taking pictures. So I borrowed a camera from my father, bought some trays, a darkroom light, raised Eastman Kodak stock by destroying a lot of film. Mm-hmm. And we had a camera club for a while. Last time I checked, one of them is a astrophysicist at Caltech, mm-hmm. one of them is a retired restaurateur, and one is a retired shoe salesman, and I'm the photographer.
All right.
I took a lot of pictures. In high school, I did not work for the school paper. I did not take direction well.
Okay.
I shot mostly for myself. I did a lot of experimenting. And came time for graduation from high school, I had to go to college. That was a given. And I wanted to be a doctor. Then I realized how long you had to go to school. I wanted to be a physicist, and I realized you had to be able to count. Mm-hmm. And there were two schools of quality that were giving bachelor's degrees. One was the Los Angeles Arts Center in California, mm-hmm. and the Institute of Design up on Dearborn Street here. Mm-hmm. I chose California. My parents chose Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I started there having absolutely no idea what I was getting into. I did not know what the Institute of Design was. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what the Bauhaus was. I walked into this building the first day, and I was just a lost soul.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when I saw a sign that said the VD students will meet in the auditorium. And the only VD I knew was not visual design, but that's what it meant. And I got to meet the two people who would be my professors for most of the 4 years, Aaron Siskin and Harry Callahan. One was a lifelong friend and one was a lifelong enemy. I began taking classes. We didn't take a lot of photography the first year or so. We took design, we took painting, we took sculpture. I learned more about lighting and composition in a sculpture class with a wonderful Italian sculptor whose name I was about to tell you, and I just can't think of it suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
And then we began doing photography.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the second year, Harry Callahan came to me and said, I think you should quit school. You're never going to be a photographer.
Mm.
And like a good student of the 50s, I was a sheep, and I went to my locker and I started packing things up, and Aaron Siskin came by.
Mm-hmm.
He said, what are you doing? I said, I'm quitting school. Harry said, I will never be a photographer. In Yiddish, he said to me, Nishke Fairlecht, it's no big deal. You'll never be his kind of photographer, but he's going on sabbatical. I'm taking over the program. I would like you to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward 30 years. I'm teaching photography at the Rochester Institute of Technology, and Aaron is coming to town shortly before he died, and he's going to be a guest of the Eastman House. And I asked him if he would talk to my students. So he said, yeah, bring them over. I brought my class over, and I told that story. And I turned to Aaron and I said, is that the right story? He says, yes, but you forgot the rest of it. And he turns to the class and he said, a year later, I asked him to leave. He said Howard was the only person who actually wanted to earn a living as a photographer. Everybody else wanted some low-class job like an archivist, a librarian, you know, historian, or a fine art photographer. He said, and you're asking all the wrong questions. If you can find a good young photographer who will keep me posted on what you're doing and you apprentice with him, I will give you credit for your senior year of photography. And I found a photographer named Jack Desort, who later became a cinematographer in California. And I worked for him until I went in the service after graduation, was gone for 6 months, came back thinking I had a job with him, and apparently the IIT student I had replaced me was easier to get along with than I was, and I didn't have a job. So that's how I got started.
Okay. Got to go back, and so you're a native Chicagoan.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. Uh-huh. Born and raised in Chicago.
Okay. And the school where you had your eighth grade photo club was?
Rogers School.
Rogers School, okay.
And high school was Senn High School.
All right. So how deep do your family roots go here? Did your parents come from?
My father was born in Chicago. My mother was born in New York City, but I think she came when she was just a couple of years old.
Okay, so.
And they were first generation.
Solid roots, so. Cool.
Yeah, you're not our first interviewee who attended IIT or one of its satellite schools, kind of without any knowledge of the kind of big names that were there.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, I used to come into Crown Hall and listen to Mies van der Rohe lecture, and I didn't know who he was at the time. Less is more. You know, what does that mean? Uh-huh. And as I said to you at lunch today, mm-hmm. I had a design professor who taught in Berlin. My sculptor instructor was from Europe, Italian, and I had an incredible education here. It's based on something that Aaron Siskin said in class, and I've taught around the world, and every time they do a story about me, they have to put his quote in English, no matter what language is written in. He said in the third year class, I'm going to teach you how to see. The technical shit you can learn somewhere else. And that's been my theory all along. So first you have to be able to see, you have to have something to say, and then you need a technique to make it work.
All right. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the 1 year between 54 and 55 when the Institute of Design was still at 632 North
Dearborn.
North Dearborn in the old Chicago Historical Society building. How did that look? What was it like attending school?
It was a completely different atmosphere.
Yeah.
Many of us thought that it was a terrible mistake, and I still think so, for the Institute of Design to move here.
Okay.
When we moved here, most of the minority students, most of the really arty students, and virtually every one of the gay students quit school and went somewhere else.
All right.
They did not feel at home in a technical institute.
Okay.
I was maybe a little more flexible, and I just wanted to see what it would be like. Mm-hmm. But my entire core program was done there.
Okay.
The design and the sculpture and painting and stuff like that, it was virtually all done there.
Uh-huh. So you like your colleagues more back on the north side, or that bohemian, you
know, a lot of
more bohemian type character to it?
Yes. Uh-huh. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot, you know, I told you at lunch, with 35 of us started in photo. I'm the only one who graduated 4 years later in photography. I'm trying to think of the name of the other guy who graduated. Oh, I heard his name on the tip of my mind before. Uh-huh. He graduated in photo education, art education. Uh-huh. But I told that story for years, and I thought, that can't be right. So I found the program for my graduating class, and sure enough, the only person who got a BA in photography was me.
Huh. Did the other programs in the Institute kind of suffer the same?
The design program stayed very much the same, and then a new director took over. I wish I was better with names. He was from Pratt Institute, and he made this Pratt West. It was a completely different philosophy of design and imaging, and the whole school began to change. I came back for a reunion maybe 20 years after I graduated, and I saw what had become of the Institute of Design. And the next time the fundraisers called me, I said, you destroyed my school. I said, don't call me again. Hmm. I have pushed the school since then. The director of the program I taught at RIT is a fine art graduate from here, a number of years after I was here. And I ran into a lot of people from the school. So I have great respect for what the school was doing then. And as I see more and more photo programs being dropped, it bothers me. But I have to tell you, I quit teaching. I retired early at RIT because I didn't like the direction that the photography was going. I didn't feel they were being honest with the students. And I said, it's time for me to go do something else. So I retired for a second time.
Mm-hmm. And this one continues.
This continues.
Yeah. So I just want to pursue that late 1950s or mid-1950s sure. Bohemian ID when it was still on the north side. Once you started your own business and you were here until 1978, did you link up with some of those students who didn't end up graduating?
No.
They just went their own ways?
My only friends from that period of time were friends I made outside of the school.
Okay.
I still have a lot of close friends who graduated in engineering, or graduated in architecture, graduated in science.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so out of touch with what the philosophy was of most of the other students mm-hmm. that it just didn't work for me.
All right.
And I think that's why Aaron followed my career. Mm-hmm. Aaron kept track until he died of what my career was. When I sold my studio in Chicago and moved to Rochester to teach, I got a postcard from him on the back of one of his photographs that says, "I'm glad to see you finally went straight."
So the shift that kind of went on, that you said, you know, the school moves down here,
mm-hmm.
and the character of the place changes.
Completely, yeah.
Was that kind of the beginning of the transition of kind of the from the classic ID of, you know, the Bauhaus and I guess what you were saying about Aaron Siskind, the learning how to see. Shifting more towards, I guess, an industrial design, because there was that period of ID later on where I think, you know, the school became much more known for industrial design,
right.
and that sort of thing. Was that the beginning of that shift?
I think so. Yeah, I'm trying to think of the name of the New York art designer who came here to head the school. It's only been 50 years. I don't know why I can't remember.
Well, he came from Pratt.
I think so. Yeah.
With that,
he designed the Studebaker. He designed. I just can't think of what his name is.
Okay, yeah.
But we referred to the place as
Pratt West.
The previous director carried a lot of the feeling of the old building down here, and he knew a lot of jazz musicians. And we used to have very famous jazz musicians play in the lobby downstairs, outside the dark rooms and stuff of Crown Hall.
Oh, okay.
We had great jazz concerts there.
Wow. How was it moving in to Crown Hall when it was fresh and new? And
it was clean.
Uh-huh.
It hadn't started to leak yet.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And being cheek to jowl with the architecture program and
nothing. There was almost no contact.
No, really? Okay.
We were in the basement, and they didn't talk to us, and we didn't talk to them.
Okay.
And I would sneak upstairs to listen to Van der Rohe speak.
Okay. We've heard that from other people, haven't we?
Yeah.
It was very separated.
All right.
And was that, do you feel like that was on purpose, the separation?
Yeah, we were photographers and they were businessmen and, you know, really much smarter than we were. They knew how to draw lines and make bricks and do all kinds of stuff.
And so you're here for the 4 years. Well, for 3 years, and then you...
I took other classes during that third year.
Okay.
It was only the photo classes I was not allowed to come to.
I see. Okay.
When you were hired by Jack at Desort?
Desort.
Desort. Is that here in Chicago? Or
yes,
was
it was right around the corner from the old Institute of Design.
Oh, okay. So you went back to the north side.
Right.
Oh, okay.
And I worked for him for probably a year and a half.
Okay.
And...
While you're finishing up.
Right, and he taught me the business end. I mean, I know how to run a business. I learned that from him, dealing with clients, which is something it's very hard to teach in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not have a big ego. Occasionally a client would say, this is not a big shot. You want to have Howard shoot it? And he'd let me go out and shoot. The very first ad I ever took was for him. It's the back wheel of a truck getting mud flaps on it. You have that picture in the images. So he was very nice that way. He also had a partner who was a scuba diver, so I learned to scuba dive and do underwater photography with him, which I got to use when I went into business for myself. So it was a great experience.
Yeah.
And how do you feel like the kind of the education that you got from ID and Aaron Siskind, how did that prepare you for be advertising photography?
He taught me how to see so well that I could be a mimic. When I worked at Shigeta Wright, which is the second big studio I worked for, one in Cleveland and here, if the lead photographer would take a vacation, was in the middle of an assignment, I could finish the assignment, and you couldn't tell which one of us took the pictures, which really ticked him off. I could look at any photograph and tell you exactly what time of day it was taken, who, you know, what kind of photographer took it. I can tell you all the details of it. Can't anymore because of Photoshop. But at the time, I could see things that other people couldn't see. My wife and I would go vacationing with other friends in the woods. I would take them in the woods and find deer for them that they couldn't see. I just learned how to see. When I taught at RIT, I did a course on light, not lighting, on light, to show people how to make things look exactly like you want them to look, or how they would look in daylight by imitating it in the studio. And that was something that nobody else there knew, but that's absolutely everything I got from Institute of Design. It was a wonderful education.
And so Siskin himself was able to
Give you some of the parameters. I badmouthed Harry a lot, because Harry and I had a run-in years and years and years later. And I always said that my work looked a lot like Aaron's work. And I went to a show that Harry put up, and I said, oh my God, my work looks like his. It doesn't look like Aaron's. So I appreciated what he was doing. We just had a personality conflict that was just horrendous.
Yeah, and the two of them had fairly different personalities, right?
Yeah, they lived together. They both were New Yorkers, and they were, you know, Aaron was a New Yorker. They lived together. And they got along fine, but they were completely different people, different philosophy of photography, different attitudes, different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm. And were there like camps within the photography students?
I was not aware of it.
Okay.
I wasn't aware of it. We just all idolized both of them for what they could do. I thought Aaron was a good teacher, and I thought Harry was a terrible teacher, but he was a great photographer.
Okay.
It's funny, years later at RIT, we had a program going with Eastman Kodak where we would bring in speakers. It was a speaker series. And I was usually the host. I would be their person to be with for the couple days that they were there. Mm-hmm. And Harry was one of the incoming people. And the director who had gone to IIT came up to me. She says, I know how you feel about him. Do you want to have somebody else do this? I said, no, I'm a grown-up. I can handle this. So I walked into the lecture room, and he was alone in there. And I said, Harry, I'm Howard Levant. He said, I wouldn't have recognized the face, but I could see the attitude immediately. I thought, well, maybe I was wrong about being able to do this.
How did it go after that?
We talked to each other. We were pleasant.
All right. Okay.
Wow. And so you said that Aaron had told you you wanted to make money, so you were...
I wanted to be a professional photographer.
Yeah, so you were different than,
right,
than the other folks.
A lot of the students who started became professional photographers, but they were coming back from Korea, and they wanted to get in and out of school as fast as they can, and most of them left after the second year with jobs to do. They just felt they put in as much time as they could in school.
Okay. But at that point, you were kind of the oddball.
Oh, yeah.
Looking to turn this into a professional,
yes,
career.
I wasn't as arty as the rest of them. I hate that artier than thou attitude. You know? Mm-hmm. Where do you want to go? Where do you want to go from here?
Okay. Well, let's see. What took you to New York?
No, I went to Cleveland.
Cleveland. Yeah. What took you to Cleveland?
Okay, I came back, and I had no job with Jack, and I started looking for a job, and jobs were rather scarce. And I had a distant relative who was a really good designer. And he owned a chain of design studios in Cleveland, Boston, Toronto, and Rochester. And he called me up and he said, we're losing our photographer. Do you want to come and be the photographer here? And you'll like this part. I said, you've never seen my work. He said, did you graduate from the Institute of Design? I said, yes. He said, you're hired. So I went, I said, I'd like to see what you guys do. So I went there, was very impressed with the work they did. And I moved there that September.
of 59. Okay.
And I worked there for, oh, maybe a year, year and a half. And the relative had a heart attack and wasn't doing much in the business. And his partner and I banged heads a lot. So I went across the street to one of my competitors and said, hey, you shoot a completely different style of work than I do. We have different clientele. Why don't we merge and make a big studio? And we did. His name was King Beach. And within a year, we swamped the art director show. That picture I showed you downstairs, the little girl with the balloon, that took best of show for the art director show in that year.
Okay.
And but I didn't win, he won. So it was a great year for us.
Okay, 61 to 62.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And I was not crazy about Cleveland. Cleveland was a really run-down city at the time. It's come up a long way. Mm-hmm. People say it's because I left. but Shigeta Wright, one of the owners who was a salesman, sold in Cleveland. And he had gone to the art director show. And he looked me up and he said, do you want to come back to Chicago? And my wife was anxious to come back to Chicago, where we were both from. And we had a child at that time. And we wanted to be with family. So I came back to Chicago with a portfolio. And it's interesting. When I showed my portfolio, I started showing it, and they said, don't show us the work you did for jobs. Show us the work you did on your own, for yourself, which is mostly the stuff that was influenced by here.
Mm-hmm.
And they hired me on the spot. And I worked there for about, I went there in 62, I left about 2.5 years. Sometime in 64 I left.
You said September of 62, I think, right?
September of 62 to June of 64.
Okay.
And that was an amazing, amazing place. I mean, I learned all the technique I never learned in college. That's where I learned it. These guys were absolutely amazing photographers. Mm. We had our own dye transfer lab. We had our own processing lab. We had our own black and white lab. We had a full-time carpenter. We had a full-time kitchen with kitchen help. We had, you know, everything was there. Three major photographers and assistants and one minor photographer. The lead photographer had just left. Everybody moved up a notch, so I became photographer number three. And they were taking a risk with me because I did not shoot like a Chicago photographer shot. Between the Institute of Design and Cleveland, which was visually way ahead of Chicago, I was shooting a completely different style. And I have to give them credit for taking that kind of a risk. And the pictures I showed you before was an example of some of the style. I could shoot the formal Chicago still life and food photograph. Long lens, everything very linear and very straight. And I looked at what the New York photographers were doing, and I knew how they were doing it. And I said to my partner, who had left Shigeta Wright with me, I said, let's see what happens if we try to shoot this way. Well, talk about a dud. Everybody loved the work, but nobody would hire us to do that. They would hire us to do Chicago-style photography.
Hmm.
My partner was Michelle Ditloff, who was a designer and photographer. He had been an assistant to Shigeta Wright. And between the two of us, we began to change what photography was looking like in Chicago.
It's really worth getting into that in some detail. Why do you think there was this Chicago style? Is it maybe a result of Chicago being this real commercial hub, or they had a whole history of images for catalogs and things had to be very documentary?
A lot of the advertising photographers had come out of the catalog world.
Yeah.
And understand that advertising at that time in the 50s, the art directors had mostly came out of the words. Mm. Early art directors had all been copywriters. So there was no freedom of visual expression.
Okay.
And we were losing work to New York City. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the agents began to say, we need to find people who can shoot more like they do in New York City, but a little bit at a time. Mm-hmm. And Michelle and I were sitting there waiting for it.
Mm-hmm.
And we began shooting like that.
So getting away from that very strict representational, just back up the description.
It was gorgeous. Uh-huh. I still love Chicago style. When I shoot for myself, landscape, I look at the structure and I say, that's Chicago style. Still life I'm making out of this landscape.
Yeah, yeah.
But
is it looking for various geometric arrangements? I'm sorry, I'm not as...
All of my photographs are made of triangles.
Okay, all right.
And most Chicago photographers make them out of squares.
Okay, all right.
I've said that to somebody once and I got a dirty look. But it began to go.
Yeah.
We opened up our doors that June, and we never had a month we didn't make money until 5 years later when a huge crash happened in the advertising world.
Okay.
And Michelle and I had a difference of opinion on how to run the studio, so we split.
Okay.
And he went into another place, and I kept the studio that we had built.
Yeah, get down a bit more detail about this new style.
I'm sorry.
Introducing the style to Chicago. You were showing some examples to me downstairs,
right.
Much more, for example, the shots of food, closer in, a bit more.
The Chicago style food photography was a portrait of the food.
Mm-hmm.
You sat back behind a wall, which the long lens tends to make in a photograph, and you just admired the beauty of the food.
Okay.
What the New York photographers were doing was going to wide-angle lenses, some distortion, shooting from a higher angle as if you were sitting at the table and the food was right there and you could reach down and grab it.
Okay.
And they looked at it and said, but that bottle is, the bottom of the glasses is distorted.
Uh-huh.
I said, that's how it would look to you pretty much if you were sitting there and looked down at it too.
Uh-huh.
And suddenly it began to go.
And that's more and more what people wanted in terms of...
I think they were tired of losing work to New York, so we began to pick up work that had been going to New York.
Right.
But the ability to see like that,
mm-hmm.
one of my biggest competitors died of a drug overdose because he could never change his style.
Mm-hmm.
But people still occasionally wanted that style, so when mm-hmm. he died, I got a lot of his clients. Because they knew I could look at his work and say, they say, shoot like he did when he did this, and I could do it.
Okay.
Hmm.
Then I would show them a different way of doing it, and some of them I could convince, and some of them I couldn't. But I got his clientele when he left because of what Aaron had done for me. I could look at his pictures and say, oh, he did this, he did this, he did this. That's how this picture was made.
Hmm. All right, so you're able to play both sides in a way, or mm-hmm. get work both
The only
both
photographer
styles.
I couldn't do that with was Irving Penn in New York. Because he had his own in-house retoucher who would add shadows and remove shadows. And I could say, you can't do that. You can't take the picture like that.
Wow. And is it also during this period in the 60s that you developed another thing you were telling me downstairs in the collections, that eventually many of your clients didn't even have to give you layouts for
right.
material because you could compose it
there? I was tactful enough. Even though I realized as a photographer, I could probably come up with a better photographic idea than a designer could.
Mm-hmm.
I would get an assignment from somebody. I would shoot it exactly the way they asked for it. And then I would shoot it for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would take it in, or my rep would take it in, and not saying, hey, dummy, this is how it should look. I would say, this is what you asked for. Oh, yeah, that's just what I wanted. I said, I got so turned on by this assignment, I decided to do some experimentation. I just want to show you a variation I came up with.
Yeah.
More and more, they began buying my variation to the point where my later clients very rarely gave me layouts. They just said, here's the space we have to fill, here's who we're talking to, here's what we're trying to say, make a picture. It's a high risk. I had photographer friends who would not do that because if you blow it, it's on you. If you follow the client's directions and it's blown, it's on them.
Yeah.
And it didn't bother me. I felt very confident. I was also very cocky.
That hasn't changed.
I noticed that. People keep telling me that.
And so what sort of customers were you working with at the time? Was it largely Chicago-based businesses?
I started out doing Chicago-based businesses. I had made some contacts while I was at Shigator Wright with out-of-town clients. My major clients were in Chicago. I did all the Gerber babies.
Hmm.
I did Sara Lee. I did United Airlines. Did everybody. I worked for just about every agency on every client. Then I began picking up work out of Milwaukee and out of Minnesota, the Twin Cities. Because for them, it was a big thing to go to a big-time photographer in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And here, the actor said, I want to go to New York and work for a big-time photographer in New York. I never chose to specialize, and I lost a lot of assignments because of that. I could not work for Pillsbury because I didn't shoot cakes every day. I shot babies. I was a medical photographer in surgery for Kimberly Clark for years and years and years. I did a lot of the original photography on scanning equipment for MRIs and CAT scans and things like that. I told you I was photographing CAT scanners when they were made out of 2x4s and pipe. I mean,
wow.
they hadn't even put the body together yet. I shot in factories. I shot everywhere. My attitude was, I can go into a U.S. Steel and photograph inside and capture the heat coming out of the ovens. And then a couple days later, I'd be shooting a food shot near an oven, and I'd say, ooh, I know how to make that oven look like heat's coming out of it, because I saw that in the factory.
Yeah.
And
the kind of broader approach to things you already sort of knew from common sense was going to be better for you anyway, in terms of your artistic.
But I lost a lot of clients because of that, who wanted somebody who was a specialist. I also lost a lot of clients because I refused to have any drinking in the studio until after a job was done.
Okay.
At Chiquita Wright, it was a serious problem. You'd do a job in the morning, he'd go out and drink his lunch and come back and change his mind completely, and you start the job all over again.
Wow.
And I said, but I have my own business, and this is not going to happen.
Yeah. Wow. You were mentioning also that you had a number of models who just sort of continued through with you. How above average were you in terms of having continuity of people that you could call and work with, or was it more fluid than other people had? Or
I didn't use anybody on the job unless I'd already photographed them. So I'd make myself available evenings and afternoons and have models come in, male and female, and test them. They'd get shots for their book, and I'd get samples. A lot of the things you saw downstairs mm-hmm. were samples I had done with models. And I also used more actors and actresses than I did models.
Hmm.
My attitude was, models have two expressions, smile and don't. On a series, the series I showed you of the historical medical
uh-huh.
scenes,
uh-huh.
I could say to the models, here's the set. This is the area I've lit. Here's the story we're trying to tell. You're the professionals. Go do it. And they would come up with expressions and motions and stuff I would never have dreamed of. And when they hit something really interesting, they'd say, whoa, whoa, whoa. Do that again, a little bit slower so I can catch it.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved it. I loved working that way. So just as an aside, a couple of years ago, I was going through all the thousands of photographs I have. I opened up a drawer, and it's full of nudes of Chicago models who didn't do nudes.
Hmm.
And I called up my ex-partner, Howard Solotroff, the designer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Howard, why do I have all these pictures? And he said, you don't know, do you? He says, every model who didn't do nudes, who wanted to experiment, came to you because they felt you were safe and you would not take advantage of them. I said, that's very nice. Did they think I was a gentleman or did they think I was gay? But I have just tons of these photographs, and someday I'm going to make a book out of it when I'm sure they're all dead, of how the business made me look at women.
Yeah.
And so were you unique in the way that you preferred to use actors and actresses as opposed to models?
No, a number of people did that. It depends on the kind of work you were doing. I mean, someone like Victor Skrimneski would use models, and just high fashion models, that's all he used.
Hmm.
I did not use the same models he did, except on rare occasions.
Mm-hmm.
But I like people who are actors, who I can just tell them, this is what we need to do, go do your thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's important to put on the record here that another thing you had mentioned downstairs when we were going through your photographs is one model who, a gay young man who eventually died of AIDS.
That was my partner, my associate.
It was one of your associates, and he felt comfortable working with you and referring others in the community to you because he knew that you would be respectful.
The story I told you, we were coming back from the location,
mm-hmm.
and he was fidgeting in his chair, and I said, what's wrong, Terry? He says, I need to tell you something. I said, what's that? He says, I'm bisexual. I said, no, you're not. You're gay. He said, how long have you known? I said, since I interviewed you. He said, it never made any difference. I said, why should it? My business almost doubled. Every gay and lesbian art director in town knew they would be comfortable in my studio and they get treated with respect.
Mm-hmm.
It almost backfired on him. Our biggest client was very gay, I mean, very affected gay.
Mm-hmm.
And we took him out to lunch one day, and he turned to me in the middle of lunch and he said, is it different working with me than it is with a straight art director? And my rep just turned white. I said, Ron, working with you is like working with a woman who's always having her period. You are the bitchiest person I've ever met in my life. He loved it, and we became the best of friends from then on. He was my client until I left town. So, yeah, it was a very open studio. There were usually four or five of us. I had a woman who'd be a secretary, stylist. I had a rep and one or two assistants. And the woman was open to a lot of conversation that most women don't get to hear. And I went to her one day and I said, Sandra, I said, it gets a little rough here sometime. If we offend you, you have to let me know. She says, you don't think I work here for the money, do you? But it was, the studio had a nice atmosphere.
Yeah.
People felt very comfortable in the studio,
yeah,
including me.
Yeah, well, I sort of worked that into your whole family reality. How many children do you have by this point?
Had three children,
uh-huh,
and they all had Screen Actor Guild cards, and they all did commercials, and they all modeled for me and for other photographers in town.
All right, so it's working well,
yes,
for everyone, and you're living Rogers Park?
We lived in Rogers Park,
uh-huh,
right.
Uh-huh.
Was your studio there as well, or was it?
No, my studio was right behind the Merchandise Mart.
Okay.
On Ohio.
Okay.
215 West Ohio Street.
When you're with Shigeta, it's down south of the river, right? It's down on,
No, north of the river.
It was north of the river.
It was north of Chicago Avenue.
Okay, all right, okay. So you just are kind of always there.
Right. It was an old town.
Okay.
And the old German Bund headquarters.
Uh-huh. Wow. How was Chicago in the 1970s? I mean, you're very busy. I mean, you probably didn't have a lot.
I did. I had a lot of time because part of my job was just walking around, looking for locations, finding people on the street and convincing them that they ought to be a model.
Okay.
I'd go up around with a camera and take their picture and get their name and have them come in.
All right.
It was a great place to live. Old Town was a terrific place to be.
Yeah, yeah.
I was a folk singer at the time also, so I got to spend a lot of time down there.
Right. You have some shots of the riots around the 1968 Democratic Convention. And some of the shots are from Lincoln Park, right?
Yes.
No.
Across the street from the Congress, the hotel.
Okay.
Used to be the Congress Hotel. No, what was it?
Hilton.
Across from the Hilton.
Yeah.
Across from the Hilton.
All right. So you were there during the...
The next morning. I went in the next morning.
Because
we had been out of town, and we drove in and saw what was going on, mm-hmm, and I went back at crack of dawn the next morning, and crack was what it was, because they were still whacking people on the head.
Uh-huh.
And it changed my idea, mm-hmm, of what had been actually going on, and I realized there was a group of people there who were inciting the hippies, and they would have them riot, and then they would disappear.
Hmm.
And the Chicago police, completely misdirected by Daley, he could have stopped the whole thing in an instant.
Mm-hmm.
They came in and beat their heads in.
Mm-hmm.
And I suddenly realized neither side was right.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike people today who say there's good on both sides of a riot, neither side was right.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned that to somebody in an advertising agency, and their client was Motorola, who supplied communications equipment for the police department. You saw some of them. And
yes.
I worked for them for years because they said, this is somebody who's willing to look at police and not go, you know.
Hmm. That's true. Yeah, you did. You did. Huh. So you were able to navigate through that day or two without trouble because you just looked like you were some neutral individual.
The riots at that time were really strange. I mean, I was up on top of my studio when Chicago was burning during the Martin Luther King riots.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly a voice screamed at me from above, telling me to get off my roof. And I look up, and it's a Marine helicopter bristling with machine guns.
Mm. Wow.
And I saluted and said, yes, sir, and went downstairs, and I gave all my cameras and current records to all my employees and said, go home, take these with you, do not come back until I call you.
Okay.
And
interesting.
But we all made it through.
Okay. All right, so that you documented that as well.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, exciting time. Exciting time.
It was a very exciting time. In fact, at RIT, there was a journalistic photographer there who had been working in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
that same week.
Mm-hmm.
And he has pictures of LBJ playing with his children and his dogs.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have pictures of the hippies getting beaten. And we did a poster that was the Capitol building sitting in downtown Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And it says, you know, two views of the same week.
Hate to leave that Chicago narrative because it's just
Well, that was the high point of my yeah. active photography career was the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And by the end of the 70s, I was pushing 40, mm-hmm. an old man. And I said to myself, who do you know in Chicago who's over 40 years old, not a drunk, and not divorced, and still shooting? And there weren't a lot. Hmm. And I was asked by the head of the photo department at RIT, which is probably the oldest, largest photo school in the world at one time, if I would come and give a lecture to the seniors. I had known him both in Cleveland and in Chicago. He was a catalog photographer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he said, would you come and speak to the classes? Mm-hmm. And I said, sure, I'll do that. And my wife said she knew at that point it was an interview. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea that. It just never crossed my mind. Mm-hmm. So I went and I gave a lecture. And about 2 weeks later, they called up and said, would you like to cut your salary in half and move to the Snow Belt? Mm-hmm. They had no idea what a successful Chicago photographer was making. I cut my salary by probably two-thirds. Yeah. But I'd done what I came to do in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I went and I started teaching at RIT. Mm-hmm. And I was doing some work mm-hmm. For local clients. And there's a huge chain of supermarkets called Wegmans, which mm-hmm. are based in Rochester. And they heard about my work as a food photographer in Chicago. And they asked me to come in. Mm-hmm. And I went in with my portfolio. And they were impressed. Mm-hmm. And they showed me a brochure they had just done. And they said, can you shoot like this? You think I'm cocky now? Mm-hmm. I said, no. And if my students did, I would flunk them. So they hired me to do a brochure. And for about a year or so, I shot for them in warehouses, we set up a studio or in a conference room, and I finally said, you want me to keep doing this? You've got to build me a studio. So the art director said, ask for everything in the world because they're going to cut you like crazy. So I asked for a state-of-the-art, fantastic studio, and they built it. So for 9 years, I hired my own students and my own graduates. It's all I would let come to the studio. And I was teaching full-time, getting a master's degree, and shooting at the studio. Wow. So that was a busy few years.
Yeah, you were at Wegmans from 1983 to 1992. We'll just put it on the record.
Right, right.
All right. Well, that repaired the income loss from Chicago, too.
It certainly did. It certainly did. Uh-huh. And I loved it. And the parents of the students were thrilled because their kids got real-life experience in a mm-hmm. studio while they were still taking classes. Mm-hmm. Some of the faculty were very upset with me. They went to the director and they said, how could he possibly be doing a good job teaching and spending enough time here if he's also working at the studio? Mm-hmm. And the director came to me and she said, we've checked everybody's time. You spend more time here than they do. And I've told them to keep their mouth shut.
That's good.
It's the fact that she also graduated from the Institute of Design. Didn't hurt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Did you always feel long before 1978 that you had that teaching thing that you had to do or...
The only teaching I had really done, there was a small portrait studio in Evanston that taught portrait photography. Mm-hmm. And the owner came to me, I can't remember how he found me, mm-hmm. and he said, could you teach an advertising studio course for me? Mm-hmm. And I said, I've never done it, but I can try. And I did that for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And the other school here in town? Columbia.
Yeah.
Had me come in and do some lectures there.
All right.
So when RIT called, we'd had some tragedies in the family. Mm-hmm. And we each said to each other, you know, maybe it's time to move.
Okay.
So I sold my business, moved out of the house that she grew up in, which we had bought from her parents. It's my wife I'm talking about, who's in the room.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we moved. Yeah. Figured we'd spend a year or so. That was 1978.
Hmm. And you found it's a good size, what, 200,000 over there?
250,000 people, no traffic.
Uh-huh.
There's no rush hour. There's a rush 15 minutes.
Yeah. But yeah, it's good to get on the record that you come back. You were able to see your home, which...
We spent the yesterday
the
in the house.
The people who bought it from you are still friendly.
And she wrote to the people and said, mm-hmm. you know, can we come see our house again? So we got to spend part of the day with them yesterday. It was kind of exciting.
Yeah. And so when you go to RIT, and I'm... It's interesting thinking about your experience at ID, where you were educated in a certain way, in a way that kind of paid dividends throughout your throughout your career, and yet you were the oddball there because you were the guy who wanted to make this a professional career. Mm-hmm. How did those experiences kind of inform you as an instructor or as a mentor to your students? It sounds like you were more than happy to help out with the students who wanted to turn this into a career.
When I first went there, they had two photo departments. One was called illustrative photography, and one was called commercial photography, or professional photography. And I said, I'm a professional illustrator. Which department do you want me to teach in? I said, there's no difference in the real world. And it took a few years when I became chair of the curriculum department that we merged the two departments together. One only had thought of concept, and one only thought of technique. I said, guys, it doesn't work that way. And I was the first successful big city photographer they had hired in probably a generation. Then they hired a great photographer from New York City and one from Texas and then a second one from New York City. And between the four of us, we began turning the school around. Hmm. And at one point, when I was chair of the committee, I called everybody together. I said, we're going to rewrite the photography program. And there are no sacred cows. We're not going to save anything because this is the way RIT does it. Hmm. And one instructor quit. He could not teach any other than the way he had been teaching. Mm-hmm. And the following year, our enrollment doubled. Mm-hmm. People came out of the other departments because of the structure that we did, which was a more feeling, more humane kind of way of dealing with it. False and wrong. When I got there, you were only a success if you went to New York City to work. I said, excuse me? There's a big city that does more food photography than New York in a week than New York does in a month. I said, give us a break out there. So it was very successful. I taught, my favorite course was teaching a core course, a second year core course, which is primarily studio course. I taught freshmen. I taught advertising course in the third year. I wrote the photo business course because they had no course teaching people how to run a business. So one of the New York photographers and I wrote a course which became a required course in the curriculum. And I would bring in, you know, speakers from the profession, and hopefully, you know, they could be accountants, they could be lawyers, they could be anything. But what do you need to know to run a business? And I figure I had an effect on the school.
That sounds like it.
I enjoyed it. I love teaching. Every once in a while I get to teach now. Just, you know, there's three kids at the pool that I work at, the lifeguards are photographers, and they have me go to their websites and critique their work, you know. I get a kick out of it. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of your own kids, the three, how old were they when you left Chicago, and did they follow, or have they just gone around, they've scattered around the country?
The eldest daughter was a senior in high school.
Okay.
The second daughter was a sophomore, Nancy, and our son was in middle school. They don't have 8-year grade schools there, they have middle schools.
Yeah.
It was hardest on the oldest daughter, and we gave her the option of staying in Chicago and finishing up with her friends, and she said, I can't do that. If I don't go to 1 year of school, high school in New York, when I come to visit you or come to live there, I won't know anybody. So she was very wise, and she moved there. She ended up becoming a photo stylist in Chicago, working with some of my old clients. My middle daughter is the curator of the Oregon Jewish Museum in Portland. And my son is a copywriter in Rochester. And I've worked professionally with all three of them, which is really great.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine.
Yeah, doing a shot for Wegmans, had a huge shoot for a week, and I brought the older daughter in from Chicago to do the styling. And my daughter, middle daughter was, I go into Portland every once in a while, set up a little studio and photograph their new acquisitions. And my son and I have done some brochures and things together.
So this whole time, I assume you're shooting your own work as well.
Yes, I had to do that to stay sane.
And I expect that's kind of been the bulk of what you've done since you quit teaching.
It's the bulk of what I've done, but I also have been shooting for not-for-profit organizations in Rochester and in the Finger Lakes of New York. We have a house now on Cuca Lake, which is in the Finger Lakes. It's like the Fox Lake chain here.
Mm-hmm.
They stretch all the way across Northern New York.
Yeah.
There's 11 of them. And I I'm on the board of a couple organizations, and I'm their photographer. And I just like it. And as I told you before, I have not picked up one of my regular cameras in a long time. I'm shooting assignments with my iPhone. The quality of the iPhone 7 is unbelievable.
Quite a testimony. Yeah. So let them know.
I don't like Apple products in general, but the camera in that phone is fantastic.
That's great. Amazing.
Wow.
And recently, I've been giving lectures. A men's group in Rochester asked me if I would do a talk on my 60-plus years as a professional photographer. So I put together a PowerPoint, and I did it. And there's a really good camera club of Rochester, which is some of the best amateurs I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. One of their members was in the men's club and asked me if I would do a lecture there. So I did. Mm-hmm. Somebody was at that one, was in a camera club in Buffalo, asked me if I would come there. Mm-hmm. Someone there said, you know, there's a school in Rochester called Oasis. It's a senior. And so I just last month did a one-day lecture for them. Hmm. So I'm having a wonderful, I'm being discovered in my 80s.
That's cool. And also it's networking like you did back in back in grade school, middle school, in terms of people with interest in those things. So,
my son was an aspiring photographer and was actually quite good. And suddenly he stopped doing it. And I said, what happened? He said, I'd make a print in the darkroom in the basement, and I'd come upstairs and walk by all of your pictures hanging on the wall, and I'd take my picture back downstairs again. And that broke my heart. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to hear that.
Mm-hmm. I think that did our chronology. But you have clearly crystallized a number of really kind of poignant, anecdotes and whatnot. So what haven't we asked you that you really think is pretty important to understand about your career or ID in the 1950s? Or?
ID in the 1950s was so experimental. Uh-huh. I mean, I remember the geodesic dome that was built behind, I think I sent you photographs of that. Mm-hmm. There were just wonderful things going on. It was an exciting place to be. Mm-hmm. One of the bad things that happened was, in their omnipotent wisdom, the administration of IIT decided that all design and photography students had to take a year of advanced math a semester of advanced math and a semester of physics. Hmm. I can count from 1 to 10. Don't push me past that. And I literally flunked the advanced math course. But the teacher, who was a student teacher, flunked every one of his classes. Hmm. And the institute refused to accept the grades and gave everybody a C. Hmm. Those of us who would have flunked anyways were thrilled. Hmm. The 4.0 students were not happy at all. Mm-hmm. So the next semester I took physics, and of course they would give us optics and light. Mm-hmm. No, they gave us hydraulics and mechanics. And a couple weeks in, the professor calls me into his office and he said, you know as much theory as my science majors do. You failed every test, you can't count. Mm-hmm. I said, I know that. He said, I should fail you. But I notice on your records that you're a photo major, and we're doing some research in the lab. I will trade you a B for documenting the experiments. Mm-hmm. I said, how about an A? He says, how about an F? So I did it for a B. So that's how I got through the science and math classes.
Wow.
But the seeing classes, the design and the painting and stuff like that was just, it put me light years ahead of a lot of my competition because I could see things they couldn't see.
Yeah.
And I could pass it on to my students years later.
Sounds like going way back to what you were saying right at the beginning. The problems, however, of taking this school and putting it physically on this campus and that program having to be coordinated with other programs and other things.
It didn't work well.
Right. And so by how long, I'm sure you were kind of following things from a distance, how precipitous was that decline of those problems? It took how many?
About 10 years.
10 years. So by the late 60s, things...
By the late 60s, things looked pretty ugly. Mm-hmm. And when I went a few years after that to the reunion, I didn't recognize the work that was being done at all.
Okay. And then that's when you told them,
don't call me again.
Yeah. All right. When
Although because of this, I will probably start donating to the alumni fund again. You know. when they come back to campus.
And that'll... and we'll be fine. So, what in terms of, again, I'm sure you have followed them one way or the other. In terms of your following them more recently, what have been some good points for their turning things around?
No, I have not followed them recently.
You haven't? Okay. No. All right. Just thought.
Yeah, I haven't followed anybody recently. I figured that that part of my life is done.
Okay.
All and right. I've got, you know, fishing to do and working with my boat and gardening with my wife and
got other things. The important stuff.
A lot of things I missed out on all the years I was working.
Uh-huh. Well, you did get to fish again. That was another thing you were telling me downstairs.
Yes, that's right.
You know, one project took you up to northern Wisconsin and the upper peninsula of Michigan, and you've been a fisherman since.
Right. In fact, one of the pictures that I found downstairs in the archives up from Shigeta Wright, it looked vaguely familiar, and then I saw I have a mounted fish at home that I caught when I was a teenager. It's in that picture. I said, I took that picture. So that's one of the things I asked you to copy for me.
Another thing you said, I just want to make sure it's kind of on the record, is the fun you would have in some of these things where Howard was telling about, or there's this one picture where there's a pot-bellied stove.
It was for Standard Oil.
After it was done, Howard said to the client, thank you for the credit. And the employer said, well, we don't give you credit for this sort of work. And Howard said, well, I put my name on the pot-bellied stove.
In the foreground, it's a pot-bellied stove, and I just took out the words of the pot-bellied stove, and I restored it and signed Levant on the front. The funniest story is the three fat ladies, the Big Mama Pantyhose.
Oh,
That was a client I had in Cleveland when we were both first starting out. Mm-hmm. We both moved to Chicago, and we worked together so much that we were inside each other's heads. He moved to Florida in the 70s, and he called me up and he says, I need you to do a full-page black and white newspaper ad of three fat, different-sized fat ladies wearing nothing but pantyhose and doing something humorous that won't be offensive to fat people. And he hung up. I called him back. At that time, I think models were making $25, $35 an hour. I said, what's my budget? He says, $300 an hour. I said, I can do that. So I called the modeling agency, and I said, here's what I need. I want to have the casting call at your place so they're more comfortable. And they have to know in advance what the shot actually is. So I saw about 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of woman that day in the audition. We picked these three fantastic ladies, and they're sitting in the office, and I show them the layout, which I sketched because he didn't give me a layout. I just sketched something. And they said, we're not wearing anything but pantyhose. I thought to myself, she didn't tell them. And I said, right. And they all got up and started walking out. I says, well, I suppose for $300 an hour, I can find somebody to do it. It was like a choreographed comedy. They all turned on their heels and sat down again. And I photographed the three of them. It became probably the most famous photograph I ever did. It is the front of my website, actually.
Yeah, right. Yeah, they look very happy.
Oh, we had a great time doing it. Uh-huh. Unfortunately, they retouched some of the folds out and just made these big lumps on their bodies. But a week ago, I get an email. And a woman says, my mother gave me a photograph from the agency she used to work at, and it's these three fat ladies kind of dancing. And I never knew the story behind it, and I saw your name signed at the book. It was a print I signed for the agency. And I looked you up, and there on the front of your website is my picture. So we've been chatting back and forth. Her mother was an account executive at that agency who worked, and I called the art director. I found the art director from 50 years ago. And we talked about the picture. So it was, the internet's amazing. I've found so many models and clients and friends from the past.
Yeah, so I was saying to you, it was very body positive long before body positive.
Absolutely. Nothing to be ashamed of.
Right, absolutely.
Fat may not be beautiful, but it's nothing to be ashamed of.
All right.
Yeah, is there anything else you wanted to say that we haven't asked you about?
No, it's been a magical career. I'm one of those people who are very lucky that somebody's willing to pay me thousands of dollars a day to do my hobby, to do things that I'd be more than willing to do for nothing because I just love doing it. And I learned to be flexible. I learned to moderate my attitude considerably. And friends now say, I can't imagine what you were like now. Then if this is moderated. But it got me to go places and do things that other people don't do. I mean, I photographed people, Bob Hope, and you know, a lot of famous people. I swam to the bottom of the edge of the continental shelf off of Florida, photographing a diver. I hung half in and half out of a helicopter, photographing railroads, and I have vertigo. Try that sometime. I went inside of an unstarted but armed nuclear reactor to take pictures inside the reactor.
Wow.
And they told me it would not fog my film, and it didn't. But I said, why am I wearing a radiation badge if it's not dangerous? But I just got to do all these things and see all these people and go places that normal people don't get to go. It was a wonderful experience.
It's a walks of life.
And I think Aaron is responsible for my success because I could see things that people couldn't see. Except the two stairs in the bathroom when I almost fell in the bathroom today.
For sure. We're glad that's not a major note in your life at this point.
You can edit that out if you want to.
Quickly, so you stayed in touch with Aaron to the very end?
To the very end.
Where was he at the end of his life?
He taught at... in Connecticut.
Harvard?
RISD? He taught at RISD.
In Rhode Island.
Yeah. Okay. He taught there, and I say the last time I saw him was in Rochester, and he died about a year later. But I mean, we knew each other well enough. I would call him up on the phone. He said, "I'm busy in the doc room now. Don't bother me. Call back later." You know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Well, it's. It's great to hear that even if you've had your differences with ID, that you know the imprint of what you learned there kind of...
I don't think I had difference with ID. I had differences with IIT because I don't think at the time it was the right place for ID to go. But I understand the finances and the problems of the time. Yeah. And you guys saved the Institute of Design in some form or another, but it would have disappeared for the second or third time. They love to tell the story of how they walked out on the Germans and the Germans didn't walk out on them. You know that story?
No.
Because most of the faculty were either gay or Jewish or both. The Germans shut them down in 1939. And the faculty went to, was it Himmler? Was the
information propaganda.
The propaganda manager said, "You made a terrible mistake. We do movies. We do posters. We do photographs. We can help you sell the Third Reich." And he said, "That's a wonderful idea." So he opened a school. And they closed it and left the country. They wanted to be able to say that they walked out on the Nazis. The Nazis didn't kick them out. And they went to New York and here. But this was the successful place.
Yeah.
And I'm forever grateful for it.
Yeah, right. And the Germans, many of them make a pilgrimage to our archives, to that ID collection. And for which we're grateful. It's our most used material.
And I'm very grateful to you two for putting me someplace where when I go, my pictures won't disappear.
Well, it's our pleasure.
My son said that would be his job, and now he says, "I don't have to do that now."
Thank you very much. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you're welcome.
Absolutely.
Thank you for doing the interview and coming over.